Department you don't need to provide Security. Evidence. No, but wait. But that's so insane for you to even start to list off any evidence for that. Of course there's no truth to it. I think a lot of my colleagues are even more racist than I had realised. So many of these journalists that are now in very, very senior positions earned their respect, their credibility for the way that they reported on Iraq. And by the way they reported on Iraq was factually false. Boycotting some of these sources of information makes far more sense than boycotting Starbucks or McDonald's. These journalistic institutions have done far more to support the genocide than these capitalist organizations have.
You know, I'm really excited about my next guest. She's one of the most influential people in the field of data journalism, Mona Chalabi. She's a Pulitzer Prize winning journalist, illustrator, and creator. You've seen her work in some of the world's biggest publications, all over Instagram and social media, and most recently on streaming. Mona is an executive producer and the creative director behind number one Happy Family USA. It's an animated series about the Muslim experience in America created by Rami Youssef and Pam Brady. But Mona's work goes far beyond visuals. She's been an honest voice calling out the failures of mainstream media in covering Israel's war in Gaza and overlooking Palestinians. So today we're talking about power, identity, grief, and creativity, and what it means to speak your truth when there's much at stake.
Mona Chalabi. gotta do the Iraqi sh, not the Egyptian sh. Welcome to Real Talk.
Thank you for having me.
No, absolutely. Thank you so much for coming on.
My pleasure.
Mona, there's a lot I want to get into today, and we'll see how much we can with your time. Yeah. But, you know, you've been between London and New York. You've lived in New York. What's that experience like, living in New York City?
It has been interesting. I moved to New York in 2000 and should really know this. When did I move there? It was either 2013 or 2014.
I want to say 14, but I'm not. I don't want to say it, and then I'm wrong.
You really did your research.
Yeah. I want to say 14.
Okay, I moved to New York in, I want to say 2014.
Okay.
To work for a website that I had applied to work for.
538.
That's right. Yeah. And moved there to kind of cover a range of subjects and became very disillusioned with that particular website very quickly.
Is it because of the polling, or it was because of internal stuff?
I have, I mean, it was actually both. I spoke a lot more at the time, actually, about the polling stuff, about how disillusioned I became with this idea of, like, predictive journalism. So journalism that's trying to tell people what will happen as opposed to what is happening. And that was a really good kind of formative experience. But the thing that I talked less about was the fact that actually the editor-in-chief was a Zionist.
Right.
And that was also a consideration of mine in leaving. You know, it's funny, I remember during my job interview with him, which lasted, they flew me out to New York for the job interview. So I was there with him for, like, a decent amount of time. Like, you know, the job interview itself lasted a couple of hours, and he had a piece of paper in front of him, a pad and a pen, and the whole time he didn't write a single thing. And then at some point he asked where my parents were from, and I just remember him writing Iraq on his little pad, and I was like, okay, so that's the thing that you think is, like, noteworthy here.
Wow.
I'm trying to think whether it was Sheikh Jarrah while I was there. No, it wasn't Sheikh Jarrah.
Sheikh Jarrah would have been 21.
No. That was much, much after. There was some Israeli attack that was resulting in a lot of Palestinian children being killed, like a higher number than usual in any given year.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember the editor of that site, a guy called Nate Silver, stayed up the whole night through to write a piece about how he was worried that Israeli tourism might be affected by some of the bad press. Like, genuinely worried, because he supported Israel, and it took, like, a mass kind of staff intervention to get him to not publish the piece. And I just remember feeling very immobilized as all of this was happening, because I just, you know, you feel that visibility as the only Arab staff member. It's like you are the person who can actually say the least about that, which I don't think is any longer the case, but that was also really, really hard to navigate, yeah.
And was this the point that you knew that you needed to leave the organization?
Yeah, I mean, I actually knew that I needed to leave the job about 3 weeks in. But there was a clause in my contract. After I'd moved to the US, packed up everything, like started a whole new life. But there was a clause in the contract that said that if I left before 18 months, I would need to pay the company back everything they had invested in me, which I then wrote to HR and was like, how much do you calculate that to be? Because they'd paid for my visa, they'd put me up in corporate housing, all of that kind of thing. And they said that, they estimated that to be $100,000. So just knew that I kind of had these handcuffs and would just have to stay put for a significant amount of time, 18 months minimum. Yeah, and then obviously it's hard to switch jobs in the US as well because you need someone else to sponsor your visa and all of those things. So I couldn't even like, I would constantly fantasize about how it would look when I quit and how I would like, you know, give this massive speech about how disgusting their approach was and how awful they were. But instead I had to be like, hi, I have like this other job offer, but can I stay on your books until the visa situation like fully gets transferred over? Like you just, anyway, so I was there for a while.
There's a lot that went into processing all of that as well.
Yeah.
But you eventually did leave, and you joined The Guardian.
Yes, and I'd worked for The Guardian in London before I moved to the US to work for 538.
Okay.
So for me, actually, at the time, I'd been thinking about leaving journalism entirely. I was pretty disillusioned with it. But I thought, let me just go back to the last place where I felt good. And I did feel good working for The Guardian in London. I felt respected. I felt like I could do good work. That was the first time, actually. It was Camera. No, is it Camera? It's not Camera. What's Honest Reporting is the British equivalent of Camera, right?
I think so.
Yeah. I think that was the first time I appeared on Honest Reporting was because I talked about like the largest mass displacements in history, and I'd mentioned the Nakba, and then they wrote to my editors. But like that didn't put them off, you know? That didn't put my editors off of working with me. Anyway, so I just decided to go to work for The Guardian US.
And how was living? How was living in New York as an Iraqi British?
Oh, good question. It has changed so much in the time that I've been there. You know, like mostly the biggest change was after October 7th, right? Like sure. I think that you know there aren't in the neighborhoods that I used to live in. Certainly, there aren't that many Arabs, right? There are a lot of Arabs in New York, but again, not so many in like I lived in Fort Greene in Brooklyn. I lived in the East Village, like not so many around there. And what was interesting is that the general public, I felt like, got a kind of different facial literacy on what an Arab person looks like after October. And I became much more visibly Arab because they were seeing Arabs on their phones in a way that they hadn't before. Like, it was even the case for me actually growing up in the UK as well. I think I would just be mistaken for South Asian most of the time. Yeah.
It's interesting how you say it about the U.S. because I think I've read a quote or I've heard you say somewhere that you moving to the U.S. as a British person actually added a level, the British accent added almost a level of whiteness to you.
Yeah. I really felt that. Like, I felt like, you know, even if you go into a store, for example, I would be ignored, right? Like, if it's a nice store, whatever, I would be ignored or else, like, kind of watched. And then the moment I speak, there's this assumption that I have wealth, weirdly, with a British accent. They hear this accent and they assume a different kind of socioeconomic background. Like, it sounds posh to Americans, which is nuts as well. And they can't differentiate between different British accents, by the way, to understand what actually posh
culture
sounds
shock
like.
For me.
Yeah. Bizarre, right? Really weird. So a different socioeconomic status is conferred upon you, a different educational status you're already assumed to be. It was just like suddenly you could hear my university degree, which is just so weird. And I'm not going to lie, that was also like, you know, it was also easier in many spaces in many ways. Yeah, for sure.
And then from that, you started to have an experience where you actually felt you were becoming more and more visibly Arab.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, yes. And also, you know, my name is still Mona Shalabi. I'm, you know, in journalism spaces, it's still known, like, especially, and we'll really have to get into this, you know, at this point in my career and at every point in my career, my elder colleagues, my seniors, if you like, most of them kind of got their experience reporting on the Iraq war, right? So they had this kind of, this assumption about Iraq, they certainly recognized my last name as potentially being an Iraqi name, which by the way is also problematic because as you know, Shalabi is a name that exists across the entire
it's
Middle
very
East.
Egyptian as
and
well.
There are Palestinians called Shalabi. Yeah. They're like, we're everywhere. And it's also not the, like, there's not only one tribe in Iraq with that last name. But I was asked all the time, are you related to Ahmed Chalabi? Which is...
The Iraqi...
Yeah. So Ahmed Chalabi is the guy that was very vocal about there being weapons of mass destruction in Iraq.
To the New York Times.
To the New York Times, to anyone who would listen to him. Yeah. And there were many, many people who were willing to listen to him. And he was the one who the US wanted to put in charge after they toppled Saddam. So that question of am I related to him has kind of haunted me throughout my career. And it's interesting because I've started to move more into the art space. And even in the art space, his daughter, like, organized the Venice Biennale for Iraq, or the Iraq Pavilion at the Venice Biennale, something like that. So again, the question comes up, are you related to him? And it's so interesting because people are just like, they ask it in a very sort of neutral way of just like, are you related to him? And it's so interesting, depending on what room you're in, when you say, I'm not at all, like, these are two totally different tribes, yeah, very often the reaction is just like, oh, thank God. They're awful. Anyway.
The reason why I bring up New York is...
Sorry, that was a while ago. We were talking about
Iraq. No. This is great. Actually, yeah. I didn't know the Ahmed Chalabi thing, so this was interesting
Did it cross your mind that maybe I was related to him? No, not at all. But that's because you're a good Arab and you know that there's many of us, you know? Like, why would you think,
I mean, I haven't thought about Ahmed Chalabi in years. Yeah. It's just the fact that you brought him up now was
quite... But I think it's actually really interesting and really important to be thinking about Ahmed Chalabi right now, because there's such a parallel with, you know, it's not out of the realms of possibility that there's going to be some Iranian that's going to emerge from the woodwork who's going to say some shit about there being nuclear weapons there. And is the world going to listen to that Iranian, or are they going to listen to the very strong evidence that there actually are no nuclear weapons in Iran, you know?
I'm gonna come back to this one.
Yeah.
This is something I'm gonna revisit with you, especially when we talk about the industry and we talk about your place in it. So I'm gonna hold on to that. But before I do, the reason why I brought up New York is I was just curious about how you're seeing everything kind of happen with Zohran Mamdani and everything with him winning the primary and I guess the backlash to him winning it from both Republicans and Democrats.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts?
I've been following his campaign for a really, really long time, and he is just so incredibly consistent because he's really guided by his morals rather than any kind of political opportunism. He's an incredible politician who, you know, can't be distilled down into... Because he's campaigning on the basis of real policies, right? Which is something that the Democratic Party haven't done for a really long time. Like, instead, they've been running elections on slogans about hope that don't actually mean anything, you know? Like, there's no substance behind them. And here's a candidate with real substance who is changing the terrain of political debate in really, really powerful ways. And this is so... you know, this is in no ways a kind of a caveat on him or his campaign. And I'm worried because I think we're just seeing the beginnings of what this Islamophobia is going to look like. We're just seeing, like,
just the
beginnings. It's just the beginnings. Yeah, it's going to get so much uglier.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, there's
You've seen the tweets. I mean, Marjorie Taylor Greene put a picture of the Statue of Liberty in a burqa.
Yeah.
Laura Loomer said if there's another 9/11 that would happen, he would be to blame.
Yeah.
I mean, it's.
But that's nothing in the context. I think what we're going to really see is a rise in state-sponsored violence against Muslims. Like,
you think so?
Yeah, I really, really do. I mean, there's a lot of credible analysis that in some ways Trump is the reaction to Obama, right? It is the reaction to black people in the US having any form of visible power. And the idea of any Muslim having any degree of power is just completely unacceptable to a large section of the country. And they will react to that, yeah.
But this narrative that a Muslim is a threat to American security is I mean, it's not even backed by... It's not factual. It's not backed by data. I mean, Homeland... The Department of Homeland Security...
You don't need to provide
security.
Evidence. No, but wait. But that's so insane for you to even start to list off any evidence for that. Of course there's no truth to it. Of course there's... Like, that really... I mean, we should really, really talk about this as well. Like, the way that so much of our time and energy as journalists is spent responding to insanity. Like, actual insanity. There is no need to explain why one individual's faith does not make him a security risk.
I was just even attacking this whole narrative of the fact that, you know, Islam is a threat to the U.S. You know, this which is giving fire to this whole
Islamophobia. We're just back in post 9/11 days of being like, this is a religion of peace. Like, we can't.
It's not even that. But don't you think it would be interesting for you to point out that it's actually white supremacist violence that is the threat? I mean, that is what the Department of Homeland Security and the FBI.
Well, that's what you're trying to set me up for. That's a very, very good.
It's a data report.
Yeah. No, I see what you're saying.
I'm trying. Yeah.
I know. You are saying me, like, you should be the one to say it because it's true, and I shouldn't take that point away from you. It's just, I mean, that's kind of what I was saying, I guess, by state-sponsored violence, because to me, the state, like, it's a shorthand that it is a white supremacist state at this point.
But I'll just actually read the direct quote. So in 2019, Department of Homeland Security and the FBI did a release report, and they identified that white supremacist violence as, quote, the most persistent and lethal threat facing national security in the U.S. And this was a 2022 report. Mm.
I don't know what to say. It's like, it's so, it feels so self-evident to everyone to whom it's self-evident. I know that's just such a redundant statement, but I think it probably feels self-evident to a lot of the people watching this, probably. Mm. And that doesn't mean it shouldn't still be stated, that of course that is the biggest threat, and it's a threat that is only going to get worse, actually, because their power is unchecked. Yeah.
Mona, politically, how do you think things will be playing out, just in the general sense? I don't know where your thought is in the political sense, but is there anything that you want to comment on?
Yeah, I think there's going to be a lot less attention paid to Mamdani's actual policies, the things that he's campaigning on, things like... Back in the US, yeah. Things like free buses, improving public transportation, improving healthcare for New Yorkers, improving housing. And I think that what we're going to see is something called the Mohawk Valley Formula, which I only learned about relatively recently. And it was a way that union busting was done in the 1930s. So a company, when there were unionization efforts at the companies started to put together essentially an advertising campaign that was saying those who joined the union were anti-American. So whether you were for or against the union became a question about whether you were for or against America itself, which meant that none of the union's demands were actually engaged with, whether you believed in workers' rights to strike, improved wages, vacation time, any of those things. They were all set to one side. And I think we're going to see a really similar playbook when it comes to Mamdani, where there won't be engagement with the substance of what he is saying and the policies that he wants for New York. And instead, people try to frame the mayoral election as a referendum on whether you are for or against Israel. Or actually, they're going to be smarter and more strategic than that. They're going to pivot even harder to be like, it's going to be a referendum on whether you are or are not anti-Semitic. And it doesn't matter that Mamdani is not anti-Semitic. That's besides the point. Voting for him will be portrayed as an anti-Semitic act, and people will be forced to either engage with that rhetoric or really, really set it to one side and vote based on Mamdani's actual policies.
I mean, I know it's going to be serious later this year in the election, but you think it's going to be that serious?
Yeah, I think it's going to be really, really ugly. And again, anyone who supports him will run the risk of being depicted as an anti-Semite. I mean, I don't want to say that because that's also like, it's playing into exactly what they want in some ways. But anyway, yeah.
If we were to take everything that's been happening, and this is where I want to really dive into your relationship with this industry.
Yeah.
There's no easy way to answer this question. Mm-hmm. It's complex, but the last 19, 20 months, how have you been seeing Mona in all of this, but also how have you been seeing Mona the journalist in all of this? And I'm specifically referencing Gaza.
It's really hard. I really want to take myself out of that answer. I want to take myself out of the equation. And I wonder if some of that is like a self-preservation thing, that I'm having conversations with so many journalists who are saying the exact same thing as me, but they're not willing to like point the finger publicly because they still want the potential to work with these different outlets, and I'm the only person who's shouldering that burden. So there's part of me who wants to abstract myself. there's a part of me that hates even having this conversation. Like, I remember when I first started out in The Guardian, the data desk was in front of the media desk. Like, we had different banks of desks. So, like, there was sport, opinion, media was behind us, and then we were sat there. And I just remember thinking, God, I could hear their conversations. And no offence to those journalists, that was the desk that I least wanted to work on. I never wanted to be reporting on my colleagues. Like, it felt navel-gazy to me. It felt like, it felt quite petty at times. Mm. And now I'm like, oh no, it's so, I understand why it's so, so critical. But at the same time, I want to be doing my job and not commenting on, you know, like this broader apparatus of how stuff is operating. So anyway, that's a very, very long preamble to say that. No,
but that's interesting.
Yeah, like I don't want to be in this position. And at the same time,
you're referencing it in the sense of like identity politics as opposed to news reporting.
Like, I feel like my job is to relay information, or the job that I want to do is to relay information rather than to talk about the way in which other people are relaying information, right? Or the way in which even information is relayed. Like, that to me is like a meta stance that isn't why I got into doing this. And at the same time, there aren't many people who are publicly having these conversations. They are critical conversations. And so here I am, which is just, again, I'll answer your questions. Me saying like, and I want to answer your questions. I just wish I didn't have to, you know?
Yeah. And I'll tell you why I ask you this question. As I think, and again, this is not in me in any way trying to make you feel awkward or anything.
No.
But you know, what I'm trying to get at is that you're in a very unique position.
Yeah.
And this is why I'm trying to, as much as you're trying to detach yourself from it.
I'm part of it. I have to. You're right. Like, I have a responsibility as well as someone with some kind of visibility in the industry. Yeah. So to answer your question, I would say that it has been hard. On a more personal basis, I have been so disgusted by so many of my colleagues. I felt really abandoned by them. The very, very few that are willing to even talk publicly about the number of Palestinian journalists who have been killed, I find really, really deeply troubling. I think a lot of them simply don't care.
Is that what it falls down to, do you think? They're just not caring?
Actually, I think that's simplistic to say they don't care. I think that I think a lot of my colleagues are even more racist than I had realised, and there is still this assumption that actually maybe those journalists weren't totally innocent in some ways, right? Like, this assumption, to me, one of the biggest stereotypes against Arab is this assumption that we are instinctively drawn towards violence, which means that there's this assumed culpability about everything we do. So I don't know if it's that they assume that perhaps those journalists were culpable of something, or also there's this inclination to assume that Israelis aren't necessarily acting in bad faith, and so perhaps they were in the wrong place at the wrong time, which again, to you and I, is absolutely laughable. And I also think it's borne out in the data. Like, I've tried to show how the probability of being killed as a journalist is so significantly higher than the probability of being killed as a Palestinian who isn't a journalist. And that can't be down to, like, journalists happening to be in places where they're reporting on violence, because all of Gaza is a violent area now, a place that is subjugated to violence, to be more accurate. So anyway, I felt very frustrated with my colleagues' apparent passivity about Palestinian journalists being killed, their distrust of Palestinian sources, their unwillingness to just put a microphone in front of a Palestinian and believe what they're saying.
There's always a caveat.
Of course.
There's always a caveat. Yeah. Like when the reporting by Palestinian journalists is presented, there's always this little, you know, follow-up where it's like, you know, we couldn't independently verify this information.
Yeah, which doesn't happen, by the way, if it's the IDF being quoted or Netanyahu or Trump. I mean, actually, they do that with Trump. It's so much of it is the way that the information is structured. So, okay, there are many forces that have long been at play in the way that journalism is conducted that before October 7th were deeply problematic, right? So again, there is this tendency to, if an official says something, to start the first paragraph with that quote, saying who said it, when they said it, and then you get in further down to the questioning of that statement, right? In fact, one way that I would say to viewers, if they want to change some of their media habits, aside from not reading some of these sources altogether, and I would argue that actually boycotting some of these sources of information makes far more sense than boycotting Starbucks or McDonald's.
Really?
Because
that's an interesting take.
These journalistic institutions have done far more to support the genocide than these capitalist organizations have, in my opinion.
Sure.
So I would argue one of the things that viewers can do is to actually stop consuming information from those sources. But if you really, really insist on doing it, one thing that you can do is read the article in reverse. So if, for example, you're reading a 1,000-word piece on, let's say, the way that humanitarian aid is distributed in Gaza, read the last paragraph first and work backwards from there. Because very often, the voices that are questioning those with control and power and authority are relegated to the very end of the article. And that is deeply problematic because as journalists, we have access to so much analytic information about the way that our work is consumed, right? I'm sure you have the same here in The Guardian. At The Guardian, we can go into the back end of a piece and see how many people are reading it in real time, how long they're staying on the piece, even where they're clicking on the article. So we know as journalists that many people don't read beyond those first couple of paragraphs. So in many cases, these articles that are simply parroting exactly what the state has said before questioning it, a reader will go away with simply knowing exactly what the state has said. That's it. And nothing beyond that. And I would argue that actually what we're seeing is that many journalistic institutions that pride themselves on holding power to account, which is part of the reason why I got into journalism, have simply become extensions of state media. And we also saw that in the Iraq War. I mean, part of, again, my personal journey has been a frustration and disappointment with myself about, I don't view myself as a naive person. And I also am just wondering, like, how could I have gotten into some of these rooms knowing what I knew about the way that Iraq was reported on? I don't understand why I thought that, like, something had changed.
I mean, that's an interesting point because didn't the New York Times put out an inquiry where they said that they were misled or something along those lines?
Yeah, so this is the standard line, which is that we did the best with the information that we had at the time,
right.
Which is a falsehood. At the time, there were many, many people working in the US, in US intelligence services who were saying there is no credible evidence that Saddam has a nuclear weapon, and the evidence for weapons of mass destruction is actually very, very unclear. There were many people that were saying there is no evidence for it, and there were some people that were saying there is some evidence. But instead, the line that they took was simply repeating what US officials were saying, what people like Ahmed Chalabi were saying.
Yeah.
And saying there is evidence that there is that there are weapons of mass destruction. So to me, it's just to say we did the best with the information we had is a lie, because there was other information that was available that was simply ignored. And the exact same thing is happening now. I have no doubt that 20 years from now, maybe less, the New York Times will do an inquiry into their reporting on Gaza.
That was going to be my follow-up.
Absolutely. And they will say, you know, mistakes were made, but we did the best with the information we had. And, you know,
does this go back to this quote that's being widely shared? It's like, one day everyone will have been against this.
Yeah, that Omar al-Akkad quote.
Omar al-Akkad, yeah, exactly.
Yeah. It's interesting, though, because I would say that there are many different types of, we were always against this, right? So there is the, like, there's like the member of public who was like, oh, I was really, really scared to speak out because of this and that in my personal life that meant I couldn't say, but I really, really was against this. And then again, there are these institutions of power who are going to claim that they genuinely didn't know any better. And again, I just find that really, yeah, really troubling. The other thing that really disturbs me, actually, and has always disturbed me as a journalist, is the role of opinion pieces and editorial pieces. I always found it kind of bizarre, I guess, as a journalist, that we also publish these pieces that are just matters of opinion on our websites that are dealing with fact, or at least attempt to deal with fact as best we can. let alone editorial pieces, which are, we're claiming that we're these...
organization itself.
Exactly. Yeah. We're claiming that we're these neutral, objective organizations, which I think is a flawed stance anyway. And then you're just going to have the most senior people within that journalistic institution say, this is what we think. This is who we think the next president of the US should be. They regularly do that, which is absolutely wild. These editorial boards often side with those in power, which is, again, totally contrary to my understanding of journalism, which is to question those in power. And so one of the really interesting is a weird word for it, but one of the very telling changes that has happened since October is that when Arab journalists have been asked to contribute, and especially this is especially true for Palestinian journalists, to contribute to the websites of places like the New York Times, these mainstream places, it has been on the opinion pages. And actually, right. I've been asked once to write for the New York Times since October, and they approached me to write an opinion piece, and I said, absolutely not. Like, the work that I'm doing isn't a matter of opinion. It's a way of actually saying that our perspective is based entirely in identity politics, exactly. Which is not what we're saying. Yeah. I'm not saying I support Palestinian freedom because I'm Arab. That is not my stance. I actually think it's my journalism that really, really informs my approach to Palestine. So I just find that really, really insidious, this idea that, we belong on opinion pages. And then when you really get into the way that writing is done, it's very effective. So actually, I grabbed a couple of screenshots.
Sure.
I want to talk about like the way that you actually even make this distinction between what is news reporting and what is opinion reporting, right? So I'm going to read you two different opening paragraphs, both of them published after October 7th, both of them published within weeks of each other. And I want you to tell me which of these is opinion and which of these is reporting, right?
Is this a test for me?
It's a test for you. Like, let's see how well you do. Okay. So one of them starts with, on the afternoon of his 15th birthday, Atiyah Nebahin was walking home from his school in Gaza when an Israeli soldier shot him in the neck. It was November 2014 and Mr. Nebahin was on his family's land, situated about 500 metres from the militarised green line demarcating the Gaza Strip. Okay. Then the other piece it's not an opening paragraph, it was just in the article. It says, the court decision goes to the heart of the debate over whether Israel will remain a thriving democracy, which is vital to its special relationship with the West. You know, because I'm asking the question like this, you know it's going to be...
One.
Yeah, of course. So that second piece that describes Israel as a thriving democracy is a piece of news journalism.
Yeah.
Like, how do you justify... And these are both pieces from the New York Times, sure. Right? How do you justify an apartheid state being described as a thriving democracy when dozens of human rights organisations, very, very credible human rights organisations, in other contexts when they're not talking about Israel, are regularly quoted and respected on the pages of the New York Times? They're disregarded when it comes to this, right? And the main distinction between these two pieces, by the way, is that one of them was written by a journalist who has spent a lot of time in Israel, a white US journalist. And the other one, the piece that was describing this Palestinian who was shot, was written by a Harvard PhD student who is a scholar of genocide, who happens to be Palestinian. And so he actually can't be trusted to be a credible source and expert on this question of whether or not what Israel is doing constitutes genocide, despite his very, 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 very credible resume.
Yeah.
The fact that he's a Palestinian means he actually belongs on the opinion pages.
And I think there's, even to add to that, is that there's, I feel like with these like legacy media outlets, these institutions, they always present this paradigm when you level that criticism at them, is that there's a paradigm, and for some reason there's objectivity on one end of the spectrum, and then there's subjectivity on the other side.
Yeah.
And it's always like, you know, we're criticized because we're being objective. Everything else is rooted in subjectivity.
Yes, yeah. Well, I would say that, first of all, those debates can be quite orchestrated in very, very interesting ways. So, for example, the New York Times very often says, I shouldn't even just say the New York Times, many of these organizations are saying we're being criticized on both sides, right?
Yes, because they're neutral.
Yeah, because we're neutral. And that's evidence, actually, that we're doing a good job because we're being criticised on both sides, right? Which the both sidesism implies that these two sides are equal, which is, as journalists, again, our whole job is to recognise power dynamics. So you don't equate two sides equally. in anything that you're approaching, you see, you look to see where power lies, and you treat those two different organizations, entities, individuals. If I'm interviewing two people, someone who dropped a bomb and someone who had a bomb dropped on them, I'm not treating those voices in the same way. So anyway, that both sidesism is really, really dangerous. But the thing they've done that's really, really powerful, and I'll use the New York Times in this case, is do you know CAMRA, which is the, I think it's the Committee for Accuracy in Middle Eastern Reporting or something
I've,
like that.
I've heard of CAMRA, yeah.
Yes.
And there's a New York Times relation.
Yes. So the editor of the New York Times, his father served on the board of CAMRA. And this is essentially a Zionist media watchdog that if anything is published that is remotely critical of Israel, CAMRA goes after those journalists individually.
Can I ask you a very simple question?
Yeah.
But why is that important to know?
That this is what CAMRA does.
No. But why is it important to note that this, there's a New York Times relation here? Or why is it important to note that the father of the editor...
Yeah.
Works for that organization.
Okay, it would be like, I'm trying to think of something that people won't be as, I'm trying to think of like an analogy of something that doesn't feel as contentious, which it shouldn't even feel contentious, but it would be like...
But you're right, it does feel contentious.
I know, but it's fucked up because it shouldn't be contentious. Like, I shouldn't need to constantly, which always drives me crazy as well, this need to, like, reach towards other analogies, because just looking at this directly isn't acceptable. But it would be like the New York Times reporting favorably on fossil fuel companies, and you finding out that the editor of the New York Times' father works for a lobby group that espouses the interests of fossil fuel companies. Can the New York Times be trusted to really report on fossil fuel companies when that relationship exists? By the way, another thing that CAMRA does that's really, really effective is there is a billboard that directly faces into the New York Times newsroom. So it's like a glass newsroom. And there's a billboard that faces in, and CAMRA regularly rents that billboard and puts up massive posters that say the New York Times doesn't care about Israeli victims. And they say this in all kinds of different ways. So when New York Times journalists are going into work, they're being faced with this message that they don't write positively enough about Israel. And this has been a long-standing practice long before October. So I don't know why I'm saying all of this. Just there's so many insidious ways that all of this happens.
You know what I find crazy though is that you won a Pulitzer for the New York Times.
I know. Yeah.
And you were critical even when you won, but it's just, to me, it's for viewers who don't know or may not have known that you actually won the Pulitzer for the piece you did on Jeff Bezos, his wealth.
Yeah.
And you did it for the New York Times. And yet, here you are talking about their coverage in the way that you are right
now. So I think I won the Pulitzer in May. I won the Pulitzer in the summer of 2023.
And then the ceremony was in October.
The ceremony was in October.
2023.
Yeah. I want to say it was like the 18th of October, 2023.
18th or 19th, yeah.
Okay.
But you're right.
You really did your research.
Sorry,
no, it's good.
It sounds like I'm very pretending.
No. And the day of the ceremony, I was working really, really hard with a fantastic researcher called Holly Jackson, who I'd reached out to. She'd done previous research about media bias. And I knew that I needed some kind of quantitative information to show the disparities in the way that these organizations are covering Palestine and Israel. And so I worked with her. She did this analysis on New York Times reporting, and I really, really wanted to quickly publish this illustration that day showing that the New York Times had showed a disproportionate concern with Israeli deaths compared to Palestinian deaths. And I wanted that to be published before I sat next to my editor at the New York Times.
I
was late. I was the last person into the ceremony, snuck in. Sat next to my editor and heard the opening, like the opening speech had already begun, and it was somebody describing how he was saying, you know, on October 7th, my phone started to go off, and it kept on saying, it was the exact same message over and over again, ping, 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 war in Israel, war in Israel, war in Israel, with the Israeli flag. And already I'm just like, you know,
this is the person speaking.
This is the person speaking.
And let me just clarify. The reason why I said you're late is because you were still posting that infographic that you were talking about.
Criticizing about the New York Times.
About them being biased, favoring Israeli deaths and coverage over Palestinian deaths. So that's why I said you were late.
And then, it's relevant. I'm normally on time. And then I enter this room with, like, you know, the most powerful people in my industry, essentially, right? The most respected people in my industry.
I mean, winning a Pulitzer, that's it. Like, you've finished the game.
Yeah, I really haven't finished the game, though, because the game has totally changed.
Not
now.
You as a Mona, but
I know. That's what I thought at the time. Like, it was such an incredible... When I got that news, it felt like an amazing achievement. It did. And now I feel very differently about it, you know? But anyway, he was just reporting... He was talking about how, like, you know... War with Hamas. I don't know. It's funny that Middle East, I actually put out a clip of it, and I feel like it's actually aged really badly because I think I said...
You said it's the Israel-Palestine war. It's not the Israel-Gaza war.
I know. And I hated the fact that... And this was also published like a long time after it was said for many complicated reasons. It wasn't Middle East side doing anything wrong. But I hate that I was even using the language of war then. But this was October 18th, you know? I don't know if anyone was using the language of genocide then, even though it was really, really obvious what was unfolding. I mean, Rabih Aghbaria was saying even then that actually it's a continuation and escalation of the Nakba, and he's very focused on actually using the word Nakba rather than genocide. But anyway, it was a really, really miserable night. I left early and...
Yeah. Actually, let's take this step by step because this is one of the...
Sorry, I'm going all over the place. No. Yeah.
This is great because the Pulitzer ceremony is something that I wanted to speak to you about.
Yeah.
So you publish your critique of the New York Times. You attended. Now, what most people have seen, because that video that you're referencing is, I think it's got millions of views. I think
because Middle East, I shared it. Yeah.
Yeah, but it's got like, I think I just checked on YouTube alone. It's got like 9 million or something. Yeah. It's done hits. But it's like he said, that clip is just you saying it's the Israel-Gaza war or it's the Israel-Palestine war. It's not the Israel-Gaza war. But the story itself, I don't think many people know what actually happened that night. And I think there's a lot for us to really unpack here. One of it is the fact that you said you felt like you deserved to be there at the Pulitzer ceremony, but you didn't belong.
Yeah. I still feel that in many, many journalist spaces. Yeah. I felt that very strongly. And I think that's part of the reason why it was so easy in some ways to leave early. You know, when you feel like you don't actually deserve access to some rooms, you're like really scrambling to be a part of it. But it was almost easier to leave knowing that I deserved my seat at that table, but like it was not a room that I necessarily wanted to be in anymore. And actually going back to Ahmed Chalabi, as I was leaving the room, I think it was the chair of the Pulitzer board said to me as I was on my way up, because I'd said this thing in the microphone, he was like, I just want to clarify, the reason why we say Israel-Gaza is because not everyone there supports Hamas. And I was like, what do you mean? He thought my critique was that they hadn't said Israel-Hamas. He'd like totally misunderstood. I don't even know what he was trying to say. And I was like, the language of Hamas makes no sense. Not everyone in Israel supports the Netanyahu government. You don't call it like the Netanyahu government Hamas war. And at this point, by the way, I don't remember whether I was still crying while I was talking to him, but I definitely had makeup all over my face because I had been crying earlier. And I just remember like just being in total disbelief what he was saying. And I remember that over his shoulder... Because I left before dessert was served. So the servers were still lining the room in kind of like their black uniforms ready to serve dessert. And there was a server who I still really, really, really hope I can find this person one day, who was kind of looking over his shoulder as I was having this argument with him and was going, keep going, you're right?
He was mouthing to me.
Yeah, it was a woman who was like mouthing to me, like, keep going, you're in the right. And it was so moving that... This man who had all of this power potentially over my career as well.
Sure.
I really didn't care what he had to say. I cared about this person who was just behind him, who was really, really encouraging me at a moment when I felt so alone. And then just as I turned to leave, he was like, one more thing, and I was like, yeah. And he was like, are you related to Ahmed Chalabi?
Oh, get out of
like,
here.
And I was like, no, not related to him, but you know. Well done for knowing one other Arab. And again, it's telling, right? Because he is somebody who was much older, who again would have done reporting on the Iraq war, who probably had conversations with Ahmed, right? Sure. For him, I think that was almost the way to kind of like build a bridge with me to be like,
uncle.
Exactly, I know your uncle, and actually he was a pretty good guy, and it's a shame how things worked out in Iraq, you know? Like I could list off a string of names, right? Whether it's Goldberg at the Atlantic, who reported extensively on the Iraq war. And by the way, his reporting at on the Iraq war while he was at the New Yorker is part of the reason that he got the job at the Atlantic to be editor-in-chief. So Jeffrey Goldberg was working at the New Yorker at the time, writing about Saddam Hussein, writing about the Iraq war, and his reporting was considered so fantastic that he was lured over to the Atlantic. He was showered in gifts. His children were given ponies to encourage him to go and work at the Atlantic. As I'm sure you know, but not everyone might know, this journalist is a former IDF prison guard who now serves as the editor-in-chief of The Atlantic. Similarly, Claire Shipman, who is the current president of Columbia University, did a lot of reporting on the Iraq war. She claimed that she'd spoken to Saddam's mistresses and found this information out about Saddam. Like, so many of these journalists that are now in very, very senior positions earned their respect, their credibility for the way that they reported on Iraq. And by the way they reported on Iraq was factually false.
And no repercussions.
And no repercussions. They got awards, they got prizes for it.
And then there's you winning that, you know, coveted award, the Pulitzer, the one that everybody's chasing.
Mm.
And yet you're saying you felt so alone. And you left the ceremony early. You left before dessert.
Yeah. I posed for the group picture. I'm not really sure why I did that. But anyway, they were encouraging me to do it. And it was sweet. I remember I tried to go to the back of the picture, partly because I was crying. And I remember some other journalists. Actually, it wasn't journalists. It was a guy called Francesco, who I believe won the Pulitzer for music that year. And he was like, he was trying to pass me a tissue and was saying, you did the right thing. And by the way, he's been very vocal in Palestine. But like a musician at the Pulitzer Awards, he was like looking out for me. I don't know. And obviously the following year, the New York Times won for its international reporting, which included its reporting on Israel, which again is this statement of credibility and respect for journalism that has really, really served to further Israeli interests. I don't know if it also feels, can I just say, you know what I'm saying? How I feel so reticent to be talking about the state of media and the way that journalism operates, because so much of the language around that, like if I start talking about mainstream media, if I start talking about like lies or mistruths, I sound like I'm from the far right. Like, it's really interesting that
you're right, peddling conspiracies.
Exactly, the right has co-opted so much this language about mainstream media that actually should belong to the left in some ways, because again, it's a very leftist position to question those with power. And what's happened is that journalism has become an extension of it's become a tool for those in power, many of these institutions. And again, maybe they always were. Maybe I was just naive to think otherwise.
And there's also, even when you hear people from the left talk about it, there's always a way to discredit them in the sense of like, oh, they're always talking about some nefarious plan, some nefarious agenda by these organizations.
Yeah. And there are nefarious agendas, right? Like, it sounds so far-fetched, but there really are. I don't know. And there's also really, really mundane stuff. So one of the things that doesn't get talked about is just like, you know, very often people who don't know much at all are placed in positions to write about this. So for example, at one point, the New York Times sold off part of its sports desk. And so a lot of the editors who had worked on sports suddenly like didn't have work, and many of them got reassigned to edit the Middle East Live blog. So they don't know anything about the Middle East, but they're editing those pieces. And so when they're in doubt of like, wait, is this right? Is this wrong? When they're trying to fact check it, what they do is they go to something called the Style Guide. And the Style Guide is really, really important. Again, this is the mechanics on which like the Zionist position gets upheld. There are these books that tell journalists, there's the AP Style Guide, which is the one that is frequently referenced. How should you, you know, what is the factually accurate way to use language on this or that thing? And for example, Zionism is described in the Style Guide, it's described in these really, really neutral terms, as if like, it's just a very peaceful political movement. And similarly, by the way, the Style Guide prohibits them using the word Palestine. It doesn't matter that over 130 states recognize the state of Palestine. Journalists who work at these institutions are not allowed to use that word.
Yeah.
And that further reinforces the idea that it's one state that we recognize that has credibility fighting for its right to exist among these people who are just kind of
everything else is
there.
A gray area.
Yeah, they're just there. What can you do? They're there. Yeah.
What's your relationship like with the New York Times right now?
I personally don't read the New York Times anymore. Which honestly is a shame, because I still actually think they do really excellent journalism on many other subjects other than this. I've seen, as a journalist who's worked for the New York Times, the way that their fact-checking can be really, really robust when ideology doesn't get in the way. And I still think that they can do better.
I presume you're no longer contributing.
Oh, absolutely not. No. Immediately after October, again, really, really naively, I sent them a series of pitches, which again, in retrospect, is just like,
really?
What were you?
wait.
Yeah.
You sent them a series of pitches?
Immediately after October, yeah. Okay. Immediately in the days afterwards.
The Pulitzer and the whole thing?
No. Oh. Literally before the Pulitzer. Before we sat down together, I sent them several pitches. I actually pitched them the data to show their bias and asked if I could write about and talk about their bias. Obviously not.
Did they respond, though, to that
Yeah,
one?
They said it wasn't a good fit.
Okay.
This was the opinion desk, actually. The opinion desk came to me, and I was like, I don't want to write an opinion piece, but I can do this. And they didn't respond to that. Or they said, no, thank you. They didn't respond favorably. I pitched on a piece about birthright and how birthright is, again, a form of... form of indoctrination. I don't think I used the word indoctrination, but you know, the function of birthright in the modern state of Israel and where it might go next. Weren't interested in that.
I think I heard you say something like it was just your opinion. It wasn't based on a data thing, but you said you would wager that there were less Arab journalists inside the newsroom than there were people who actually went on a birthright trip.
I think, yeah, I do still stand by that, yeah. And we're not talking about Palestinian journalists in the New York Times. We're talking about Arab journalists. I would even potentially wager that there are more journalists at the New York Times who have either done birthright or have family members who have done birthright than there are Muslim journalists at the New York Times, for example, as well, which actually is a clumsier kind of analogy. I much prefer to stay with Arab, but just like there are a lot of Muslims in the world, you know, there's a lot of Muslims. So, yeah, there's a kind of a bias that is just absolutely baked in. That, again, people don't have a responsibility to disclose. I find it quite striking. Like, if I was reading a piece from somebody about Israel, I would want to know if they had a free, all-expenses-paid trip with the stated purpose of fostering sympathy towards a country. I feel like, as a reader, you have a right to know that, but there's no obligation to disclose it. Under any other circumstance, if I had an all-expenses-paid trip to Iraq, people would want to know that if I was writing about the country.
Do you feel like you'd be held to a different standard?
Of course I would. I am constantly held to a different standard. Yeah, it's one of the reasons why I do data journalism, is because I feel so much pressure to have these numbers that are irrefutable, which they're not irrefutable. Everything is contested in different ways, and I try to communicate actually the fallibility of data. But you know, when you're saying this is how many articles have been published by the New York Times that describe Palestinians being killed while Israelis are murdered and massacred, those are irrefutable facts, you know? Yeah. Sorry, the reason why I say also the numbers don't just exist in and of themselves, all you need to do is to look at the way that fatality counts are reported. So again, we have Hamas-run health ministry with the Palestinian numbers that we know are such a vast underestimate. And meanwhile, how many places have you seen that have showed any willingness to actually break down the Israeli fatalities from October 7th to look at who were active members of the military and who weren't? That is considered so morally questionable. I just know if I were to ever even write that into a piece, it would be edited away. You can't do that. And meanwhile, it's also considered legitimate. And we even do it sometimes. I mean, I've really, really tried to avoid doing this. But separating out Palestinian casualties from women and children, like, there's also, again, this kind of insidious assumption that perhaps some of the men are guilty. Why do you need to separate out Palestinian fatalities? So you're separating out the Palestinians who are killed, but all Israelis, regardless of whether they are actual, active military personnel, are all included in this number, which, by the way, was also revised down in the days after October 7th.
you know, as I'm listening to you, Mona, one of the things that come to mind is like, what about professional penalties? I mean, aren't you jeopardizing so much by taking this vocal stance? Maybe you've already jeopardized. Maybe you've already lost on particular jobs.
I know, but what industry do I want to be a part of? Like, do I really want to be a part of that if that doesn't change? And I also would really, really hope that we see a day, talking of professional penalties, where actually there are real penalties for having told lies that directly contribute to the killing of civilians. I want to see a day in which people like Judith Miller, who repeatedly claimed that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction, actually face prosecution for the work that she has done, actually face the possibility of real repercussions for telling lies. How can that be that they and journalists really do write without fear of in the West, without fear of imprisonment for telling lies, for getting it wrong? Wouldn't that be nice? Yeah. Instead, Judith Miller now, unsurprisingly, has pivoted towards talking about, she's a freelance reporter now, and I looked up one of her recent pieces and it was talking about Israel's defense systems and stuff. Loads of these people who were writing about Iraq were Zionists. And a Zionist position is inherently anti-Arab, and there's no surprise that they supported a war in which many, many Arabs would die.
You know, one thing I don't get to speak with guests enough about is this idea of defending your right to be outraged.
Yeah.
You know, in October 23, I remember I watched this video in Gaza, and it was not graphic, but there was an Israeli airstrike, and then there was these two men that went to this father, and they were telling him he had, I think, four or five kids, and they were killed in an airstrike, and they were telling him that they were gone, and they were trying to just like put him in at some sort of comfort, and the man just absolutely lost it. And he just kept pointing to the rubble. And he kept saying, just maybe we'll find one alive. Let's try to dig one up. Maybe we'll find one here. Maybe we'll find one there. And I remember watching that video, and I just put my hands over my face, Mona, and I fucking bawled. Mm-hmm. And it was in that moment where I was just overcome with emotion, but I've never felt such disdain for Arab life before. And I look on social media, I look at the discourse that was happening around us, and it was just like almost like people that look like us also had to defend the right to be outraged about this.
I think that to me, you feeling upset about watching that makes you a better journalist and not a worse journalist, right? Like, you talked about this spectrum from objectivity to subjectivity. Yeah. I think that is a complete distraction. I think it's bullshit. You could instead view it as neutrality to non-neutrality, or I don't know what the opposite of neutrality would be, taking a position. I believe as journalists, our role is not to be neutral about injustice. Right? Like, if you're reporting, it's a total myth that you could be reporting on the killing of children and not feel anything. I don't understand how you're supposed to not feel anything. I don't know. And I also see my job as like, I'm not trying to convince people to believe anything, actually, when I'm creating these charts necessarily. Yeah. I do want to inform people. But I also think you're supposed to feel something. You're supposed to feel something when you look at a chart of how many people have been killed. You're not supposed to, like, if you don't feel anything about that, I actually think I've done a bad job as a journalist, because there should be some kind of almost accuracy in your emotional response. If your emotional response isn't proportional to the scale of what you have witnessed, then I haven't relayed what has happened correctly, you know? And I would also say, again, it's a total set of double standards. When I was going back to the Pulitzer ceremony, there were journalists that were there who were wearing a Free Evan pin, who were talking about their colleague Evan, who is in jail in Russia, had been imprisoned for doing his job as a journalist, and they were very, very angry and upset about that, as they absolutely should be.
But isn't that taking a position?
Exactly. It's not neutral, is it? You're saying this is wrong. And you have a right to be upset about what's happened to your colleague, but you, as an Arab, do not have a right to actually get upset in the same way. I have been upset. I think it would be a lie to say I'm not upset by what I'm witnessing. What a bizarre thing to say. Yeah. And you're right, it does place a certain, like, it's so suffocating, the idea that we have to, which again, as Arabs, even outside of the context of journalism, there is, and I would say particularly on Arab men, actually, this pressure to not, because you're going to be read as angry, right, you know, and your anger is, like, particularly threatening to others, there is, like, this pressure to not show anything. Yeah.
Okay, well, let me get your thoughts on this. There was a Haaretz article the other day that people were sharing, mm-hmm. and it was basically highlighting the fact that soldiers were ordered to shoot mm-hmm. Palestinians in Gaza as they were waiting for food aid. Mm-hmm. And everyone was kind of, this report from the Haaretz kind of just took a life of its own. Everyone was sharing it as like, this is proof. Look, we've been telling you. Yeah. What are your thoughts?
Very, very conflicted.
Conflicted.
Yeah, I'm very, very happy the article exists, and it tells us nothing that Palestinians haven't been telling us ever since October. The article was talking about how IDF soldiers can act with total impunity, that they shoot for fun. Again, these are things that existed also prior to October, by the way, and were being relayed to us by Palestinian journalists. And so I'm really happy that article exists, because I know people will listen to it in a way that they will never listen to Palestinian journalists. And I even felt an instinct to share it, because I knew that it would reach a different kind of audience among my followers, that people who might have doubted the credibility of some of the things that I've been saying might listen to that piece. And I also find it so distressing that I felt that instinct. And again, we as journalists have internalized what counts as a good source. So I, honestly, if it was like a former IDF soldier talking about something that he had done versus the family, a whole family, a Palestinian family who had witnessed what he had done, I'm going to be inclined to interview the IDF soldier, because I know it's going to carry more weight. And then even within that, not only is there this instinct to like disregard Arab voices, even within that, it's like, if you're an Arab voice who was born in an Arab country, who has an accent, maybe you're visibly Muslim, right? Rather than just someone like me who can say I'm Muslim, but I am the person who's disclosing it, rather than it being a hijabi who everyone knows, you know? Sure. There's also a hierarchy and a triaging among all of those voices. So I also speak with, I think, so much privilege in many ways. The fact that I have this voice, the fact that I am a more acceptable face of Islam because of how I present, it's really troubling to me. It's really troubling.
So Where does this leave your work? Is it mostly on social media now? Because you've been doing a lot on your Instagram and other platforms.
It is, but it's just me, and I think I'm like, I'm not able to do as much as I used to do. I just can't with the same kind of frequency. So yeah, I'm mostly posting. I still occasionally get commissioned to do stuff elsewhere. I'm very, very grateful for those commissions. I still write for The Guardian US. And I don't know. Let's see what the future holds. Yeah.
Do you feel like the work that you've done for Israel-Palestine isn't necessarily about this moment? It's like for future generations, maybe?
Yeah. I don't know if you feel the same. I feel like actually I feel so powerless in the face of what is happening. Mm. That I don't, you know, in other contexts, you hope that your journalism is going to inform people to take different action, right? And that different action might hopefully improve things, might make the world a more just place. And I actually I've really felt like my role has almost switched to that of historian. I feel like as journalists, yeah, we're historians now. And I don't necessarily feel good about that. I didn't ever want to become a historian. But I also feel like it's part of how we honour those who have been killed. Like, I only recently, I knew that the Arabic word for martyr is shaheed, And I just assumed that that was actually from saying the Shahada, that that's where it came from. No, because in English, the word martyr has the exact same origin. It comes from a Greek word, which means to witness. It's about witnessing. And so I think there is something really, really powerful about that, because I think as journalists, our role is also to witness. And martyrs have witnessed the truth. The martyrs in Palestine have witnessed the truth in this really, really profound way. And our responsibility to them is to bear witness to what they have been through.
You've been in Palestine when you were 20.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Is there, and I'm not trying to unpack the whole thing, but yeah. Is there any particular thing that stayed with you since then?
I mean,
maybe influenced your career in a way.
Yeah. I'll be honest, before I went to Palestine, I did think that part of the reason why I had a particular perspective on Israel and Palestine was perhaps because of the education that my parents had given me. Well, it definitely was partly because of the education my parents had given me. And I assumed that their perspective was based in some kind of pan-Arab solidarity, perhaps a Muslim affiliation with Palestinians. And it was only ongoing that I realized, like once I was there, that I realized it wasn't that, you know. It was about them actually being exposed to completely different sources of information about what was happening. They knew the things that I was seeing for the first time, whereas I, having grown up in the West, wasn't aware of what had been happening. I'll also say on like this is a slightly complicated point to make, but it is true that it was very striking while I was there, and I've travelled a lot around the Middle East and it's been striking everywhere that I go. I remember I was in Ramallah and there was like a gift store and they were selling picture frames, and like, you know, the picture frame comes with like a default picture in it. And instead of it being like a, you know, a blonde woman at the beach or whatever, it was Saddam Hussein was like the default picture.
He is so popular.
He is so popular in Palestine. And honestly, across
Jordan
the Middle
too.
East.
I went to Jordan. I went to Amman. And all I could see was just Saddam Hussein posters everywhere.
Everywhere.
On cars and shops.
Yeah. There's an Instagram account called Saddam in Amman that is just... photos of Saddam in various places. I was just in Tunisia, and everywhere you go, they say, "Where are you from?" And you say, "Iraq." And then they're like, "Oh,
Saddam!"
And it's just like, jeez. You know. And that was actually really, it was really uncomfortable to me.
Sure.
If I'm really, honest,
yeah,
if I was there,
of course.
When I was there, and I understand why so many Arabs have got this this romanticism about Saddam and Gaddafi, by the way.
Yeah.
They believe that they were these men who stood up to the West, who if they were still in charge, maybe Israel wouldn't be getting away with this. It's this like really, really alluring fantasy, and I understand it. And it is also very, very distressing to hear as an Iraqi, knowing what Saddam did to his own people, to especially minority groups, especially
Kurds.
Assyrians, Kurds, who nobody, like, you know, the Middle East just continually just kind of puts the Kurdish question to one side. Even, again, when I'm in Iraq, when I spend time in Kurdistan, I personally don't view myself as still being in Iraq. I view myself as being in Kurdistan.
Like when you're in Erbil?
Yeah. I'm not, as far as I'm concerned, I'm not in Iraq anymore. I am in Kurdistan, because to me, that is also consistent. Like, if I'm going to support the Palestinian cause, if I believe in people's right to self-determination. But again, it's so complicated, because again, when you're in Kurdistan, you're talking to them about Palestine. Loads of them are Zionist because Israel has been supporting the Kurds, knowing here's an opportunity. These people have been mistreated by Arabs for centuries. Here's an opportunity for us to go in and build... build an ally there. Anyway, I hope it's clear in everything that I'm saying. There's a level of critical thought, I think, to like every place that you are, to thinking, okay, like, I'm not judging Palestinians for their affinity with Saddam. I understand where it comes from. I understand where it comes from, whether I'm in Tunisia or Palestine or Jordan. And, it's just still quite sad to me.
And I guess my question now was how do you, or where do you see your career going?
Mm.
I mean, we've recently seen you switch gears a little bit and kind of venture into... an animated series, but like before we even discuss bits of that, I just wanted to ask you about it.
I have no idea. I really don't. I'm not thinking in 5-year plans. Or when I was very young and very ambitious at one point.
You
I was
strike
thinking,
me as the type of person who would write out all these different, you know, 5-year, 10-year plans.
Yeah. I did, and I don't anymore. I think the future is so uncertain, and I think all I can do is just like, I don't know. I don't know. I was just going to say something really like trite about like just trying to tell the truth every day, but it sounds so everything just feels quite flimsy in the face of what we're witnessing, right? I think it's really, really hard to... I think actually watching the genocide has changed my relationship with the idea of the future in itself, because I know that the future that I'm imagining is a world where... We both know where there's even fewer Palestinians, where they have potentially destroyed all of Gaza. Like, I know these are really, really negative things to say, and they feel very, very pessimistic. It's very hard to imagine anything else, and so it's hard to engage in any kind of... I don't know, it's just hard to think about the future. Yeah.
Well, okay, before we move on to number one, Happy Family USA, I do want to ask if there are any journalists, because we spoke about journalists so many times.
Yeah.
Are there any particular journalists that maybe you would want to shout out or say something about?
Yeah. I always want to give credit and revisit the case of Muntadhar al-Zaidi. So he was the Iraqi journalist who threw his shoes at George Bush. I don't want to know how many times that clip has been viewed. I'm sure many, many times. You see slippers at protests. He's kind of... it's kind of viewed as this like comedic moment, like, you know, Bush successfully managing to avoid the first shoe and then the second one.
Way, yeah.
And I think all of that is really, really harmful. So Muntadhar, before he threw his shoes at George Bush, he wrote his will. He gave his ring and his wallet to his colleague, and he said the Shahada, because he was so sure that he would be killed for this act of protest. And when he threw the shoe, by the way, he said this is from the widows and orphans of Iraq. And after, and you know, that clip is always cut off, by the way, after the moment that he throws the shoes. If you watch the longer moment, he is dragged down to the floor by Iraqi security services. He lost teeth in the violence that kind of ensued and was put in solitary confinement. And that, to me, as a journalist who has really, really taken the opportunity to hold power to account, to not let somebody have what is essentially a PR moment. Like, that was just a PR moment that was orchestrated by Bush, where every Iraqi journalist in the room was expected to be deferential to this man who had instigated the killing of their own family members. And whether it's, you know, again, it feels really counterintuitive for it to be somebody throwing something. It feels like it's not an act of journalism. But, like, again, isn't it questioning this kind of theatre that is playing out, and the legitimacy of this kind of theatrical moment, which, by the way, there was so much theatre in the Iraq War, the way that Bush was constantly construed as this kind of lovable idiot, which was a way of, again, I would say, disrespecting Iraqi life, honestly. If you can laugh at some of the things that he's saying, it really is because you don't really care about everyone who was killed as a result of that invasion.
Because that's how American media treated it, right?
The absolutely. Bushisms. Yeah, yeah, yeah. These funny memes of him kind of getting stuff wrong, because he's dumb. He's dumb. But even if he is dumb, it doesn't mean he's not dangerous. And many of the US officials at the time were saying things that were false, not because they were too stupid to know the facts, but because they knew exactly what they wanted to do, and the media just fell in line.
Well, actually, kind of related to what we're saying, but, like, you know, being an executive producer and one of the creative leads on this animated series that just went on Amazon Prime, how do you deal with heavy themes through animation and through comedy, in a way?
Yeah.
We're talking about comedy now. This is a direct example.
Yeah. It's really hard. It's really, really hard. I often use a kind of playfulness in some of my data journalism anyway, as a way to kind of get people to look for longer. There's this instinct, especially with charts. You just want to look away. They seem quite boring.
But yours elicits emotion.
I hope so. That is actually the goal, you know, very often. And so I think I've kind of played with humour before working on this, but this was obviously a totally different project. Having the chance to work with Rami Yusuf and Pam Brady was amazing. They were so thoughtful about every single aspect of this and in their approach. Yeah.
You know, Rami Yusuf said that without you saying yes, they wouldn't have made the show.
I know, it's very, very generous. I'm not sure that's totally true. He's just being very, very nice. No, it was such a joy to work with them. And I think in terms of, like, you know, giving the appropriate credit and respect to the moment, I don't know, it was really, really hard to do. I kind of, like, I really still also brought my journalistic approach to it in some ways. Even though it's totally fictional and it's scripted, you're still trying to capture some kind of emotional truth about what things were like back then. Mm. And what they were like back then was incredibly terrifying. And you see this family reacting in all of these very big and very exaggerated ways that are very entertaining to watch. But the emotional truth that lies behind that is that here are people who are very, very afraid, and that's why they're behaving in this way. And they're afraid not because they're paranoid, but because the full weight of a state and surveillance is being trained specifically on this one community.
This idea of code switching.
Yeah.
It's a central theme on the show. But
yeah.
I'm trying to see if there's anything that you brought with your own personal experience to that. I mean, was there a point when you were growing up where you maybe didn't want to lean into your Iraqi identity, especially during the invasion?
Absolutely. Oh, my God. I never wanted to talk about being Iraqi. And at the time, people didn't know any Iraqis. I was the only Iraqi in my school. I was the only Iraqi in my neighborhood. I grew up in East London. There were no other Iraqis. And I didn't even have extended family around. My extended family were in Iraq. So I didn't want to talk about it. I was very, very uncomfortable with my identity. And I only really made my first, like, Arab friend in my mid-20s, which is why I'm, like, I'm kind of envious when I look at, like, so many young Arabs in London today who are part of these, like, really, really beautiful, thriving communities, because I just didn't have that. And talking about code switching, it's really funny. Like, I still actually introduce myself as Mona, and I still feel... And I even wrote an opinion piece about why my name is Mona and not Mona, because I feel like I wanted to be, like... I mean, initially it was definitely internalized racism. And then later I would say it was also about like a desire to communicate that English is my first language. I'm not the same as an Arab who grew up in the Middle East. Like, I want to acknowledge the fact that, you know, Mona doesn't even roll off my tongue in the same way that Mona does, you know? And so I wanted to be like intellectually honest about that, because I really feel it when I meet Arabs who were born and raised in the Middle East. I've had access to privileges that many of them just haven't. And at the same time, I have to say, when I hear people pronouncing my name as Mona, I don't know, I feel differently.
You get up and leave?
I don't get up and leave. You introduced me as Mona and I was like, ah. I definitely I don't want to get up and leave. It is also my name. I don't know, I was just navigating so much back then. I just remember how, I'm just so ashamed. I used to be so angry at my parents if they would call me Mona in front of my friends. I hated it. I hated it so much.
I didn't even realize that there was a distinction, because you're pointing it out now, and obviously I get it. But
they're
like,
totally different pronunciations. No, they're
sure,
but like, and when I meet white people, if I try, because I've also, like, now some of my Arab friends have introduced me to their friends who aren't Arab, right? And so my Arab friends will be like, this is Mona. Mm. And then they're like, it's wild. It's really off in their mouths. Like, they can't do it right.
So of all the times I said Mona in this interview, though, I gotta go back
and
voiceover.
No, because also, is Arabic your first language?
I mean, I would say so, yeah, okay. But my English is much stronger.
Okay, because my rule is that if Arabic is your first language, you're allowed to do it, and if it isn't, you have to call me Mona. Because otherwise, it's also like, it feels like a kind of a fuck you if I meet an Arab and I insist on them calling me Mona. It feels like I'm rejecting our, like, shared identity, you know?
Maybe I'll hide behind that, then.
Okay. Anyway, lots and lots and lots of internalized racism. I still think I'm actually trying to unlearn in some ways, yeah. It's complicated.
You know, one of the things that you deal with on the show, which I thought was... It was just the first time of me seeing anything like it, is that, first of all, you dealt with three generations of women, and their relationships to their bodies as well. So you had Sharia and her relationship to the hijab, you had the grandmother and their, you know, relationship to the niqab, and then you had Mona. I should say.
Well, again, actually, that was one of the code switching things. I wanted her to be called Mona outside of the house and Mona when she was at home.
Oh,
so that's even part of the code switching. It's not just how you present yourself, but how you speak changes.
Right.
And yeah.
That I can relate to. 100%.
Yeah, so as far as the depiction of the way that these Muslim women looked, that was really, really important to me. I'd never seen a hijab done on screen in a way that I recognise. So many, many women in my family wear hijab. And I didn't see that particular style of hijab being represented. It really, really mirrors the way that things were in my family, where, you know, my grandmother would have been day, like, you know, would have never dreamed of stepping foot outside the house without an abaya on. And for my mum, actually, in some ways, her experience did mirror Sharia's. I was never a wine drinker. But she definitely, her relationship with Islam changed after 9/11 for sure, because hearing people constantly saying all of these things about her religion reinforced, like, the dialogue gets louder and louder in your head of, it's not that, it's this, it's not that, it's this. And the more time that you spend on thinking about what it actually is, the closer that you feel to your faith, actually. Yeah, and that's true of everything. Like, whenever people talk about identity politics, it's so often a reaction like, you know, pride marches only make sense in the context of hatred. If there was no homophobia, there's no need for people to be walking down the street saying they're proud of that identity. Right. And so, again, it's also really interesting. I don't know if I would have felt, you know, so much of my Arab identity did shift after 9/11, in part as a reaction to what was being said, which also really is really frustrating, because it still means that so much of my identity has been shaped as a reaction to that hatred. Anyway.
Were there any freeing elements to working on the show?
Oh my God, so many. It was amazing. What was the most freeing thing? I mean, not having to rigorously fact check absolutely everything you're saying, because it's scripted, that's so much easier and more fun. It was such an enormous team that worked on it. Like, it was incredible. We worked with... there were a team of over 100 designers that I was working with, and seeing all of the character designs for all of the different... so I drew, like, the 20 main characters, and then from there I was reviewing all of the designs for, like, the backgrounds and the way that everyone looked. And it was just a muscle that I had never used before, and it was just so joyous to do. It was amazing. 5 years it took us. Five years. Yeah. Wow. As Rami says, we started making the show under the first Trump administration, and it was, you know, it came out in the second one. Yeah, wild.
Well, listen, it was definitely worth it. I think you did incredible work. Thank you. Genuinely. And I think you continue to do incredible work, Mona.
See what I did there? Mona.
See,
I actually hate it. It's also weird then, because it's like, it doesn't sound right now. It doesn't sound right now. Anyway,
I'm
going
to stick
dance.
With it. You know what's really funny is that I'm about to record the intro for you.
Make a decision. Yeah,
and it'll be Mona. No,
even
it's
the,
just
even
Mona.
The, by the way, I say Chalabi, and you was like, I'm going to say Chalabi and not Shelabi.
Yeah, I was trying to be courteous.
Everyone in my family, I don't know. I think we all say it different ways. Anyway. Because in Iraqi, we do have the chuk, because we have the jim with the, like, the hut with the three noctas underneath. Anyway. Well.
Listen, I can't thank you enough, genuinely, for taking the time to speak. This was an incredible conversation.
Thank you so much for having me. Thank you.